Well, thanks for everything I've heard from other people so far. Being there for our families and breaking the distraction addiction, it reminds me of that saying, if God can't make you, if the devil can't make you sin, he'll settle for making you busy. And in our modern lives, we are entirely too busy. So I want to start with this little illustration one of my cousins, Aaron, gave at our church in Pantego years ago. It's a story that involves bran flakes and bugs that are looking for a wife. Now, there was this kind of bug who likes to eat trees. I don't know what it was, a spotted lanternfly or whatever it was. And it liked to eat trees just like we like to eat Fruit Loops. And the problem with that was the big people who lived up in the big high-rise buildings in places like Weyerhaeuser said, they're eating our trees. And because they care about money and they don't particularly care about bugs, they said, we've got to stop the bugs from eating our trees. We've got to do something about these bugs that are eating our trees. So they sat around, they scratched their head, and they called up the scientists that deal with bug problems. And they said, you've got to stop these bugs. These bugs are eating our trees. And the scientists went in their laboratories and they scratched their heads. And they thought for a while. And finally, they came up with a solution. They said, if we can keep the boy bugs from getting with, we'll just say marrying the girl bugs, then there won't be any more baby bugs. And then they'll stop eating the trees. So let's just go with that plan, they said. Now, you know, in our circles, we have our own ways of making this work. You know, the boys have ways of finding the girls. And we have our system set up. You know, you go to weekend Bible school, you try to get good at volleyball, whatever it is. You know, in some more extreme cases, maybe people try outside the box things, like what happens if I jack my truck up and put a big turbo on it, you know, and people are trying all these things, trying to figure out what's going to work here. And the girls, I'm not a girl, so I can't speak to this so well, but they have their own ways of making this whole thing come together. And maybe they try their hair just so, or they put on some perfume. Well, the perfume idea is actually pretty close to what we want to get to, because when these female bugs that are eating the trees are ready to get married, so to speak, they put off the smell. And the male bugs, he's probably lying on a branch somewhere thinking about oversleeping and that sort of thing. And he wakes up and he's like, you know what, I better find a wife. So he turns his feelers or his antennas, his nose on, and he goes off looking. And pretty soon he smells, yep, there's one over there that's ready to get married. So he navigates over logs and under logs and across the forest until he finds the bug of his dreams. And then there's lots of baby bugs to eat the Weyerhaeuser's trees. And Weyerhaeuser said, the big timber company said, we got to figure out how to stop this. So they could have maybe just put a really toxic mix in the airplanes and flew over and just killed everything. But that's a problem. And they scratched their heads and they thought about it. And the scientists went into the laboratory and they finally came out. They said, we've got it figured out. We know what we're going to do. So they said, we have the female bugs. And they put off this smell, and we can make that smell in a laboratory. We can make a smell that smells just like a female bug. Let's do that. So we got to have something to put this smell on. So they found bran flakes. You know, like you eat for breakfast maybe? Just flakes of bran. Just a really non-toxic carrier. And they sprayed the smell all over them. And then they put them in big yellow airplanes with spreader pans on the belly. And they flew over the forest like that. And they just spread bran flakes all over the woods. And everywhere one of these little bran flakes came filtering down and landed on the ground, it smelled just like a female wood-eating bug that was ready to get married. So now the male bug wakes up and he looks around and he's like, hey, this wood smells right. So he starts off over the logs and under the logs and down branches and tries to get across creeks to find this wonderful smell. And he gets there and it's a bran flake. But see, nobody has sat down with him and said, you know, a bran flake really isn't the thing to fulfill your purpose in life. He doesn't know that. He just knows, hey, this thing smells like it's supposed to smell. That little primitive thing inside its tiny little brain says, hey, this smells right. It's got to be the right thing. So the bug sits there and he holds onto the bran flake until he dies. And he never has lots of little baby wood-eating bugs to disturb the capitalist. The problem is, we've got bigger brains than bugs are, but sometimes we can be kind of like that. You see, that bug isn't doing what it's designed to do, which is to go out and find a mate and have lots and lots of little baby bugs to eat up the capitalist timber. And so the bug just sits there and holds onto the bran flake. It's not doing what it's supposed to do. And I think sometimes the devil looks at the situation, at all of us people, and he says, I don't know if I can get him to get involved in stealing from his boss. I don't know if I can get involved in bad magazines, or I don't know if I can get her to say mean things about her relatives in church. But I wonder if I could just distract them, just completely get them off over here and on holding on to a brand flake. And so he does that. And he gets his big airplanes, and they come in a variety of forms. They come in smartphones and work and other things. And he flies over our communities, and he just spreads these brand flakes all around. We're like, ooh, that smells like my purpose in life. I think I was meant to do that. And we go over and we find whatever the thing was, and we get a hold of it, and it doesn't quite seem right, but it's pretty much the right thing. And that little primitive part of our brain says we're at the right place, and we're holding on to the right thing. And we're not. And we fail to do what we were designed to do. And what we were designed to do is to carry on Christ's work on earth. We're here to carry on his work, and that is our purpose, our reason for existence. It's a very different way of thinking than some people think, even some Christians think. In fact, I remember very much thinking this way, and I'm not sure I'm shed of it yet, but instead of asking the question, how can I be of use to God's kingdom, we instead ask a very, very different question, what do I have to do to be saved? It's a very different question. One is centered on Christ, and it's other-centered. It's Christ-centered. It's outward-centered. What can I do to be of service to Christ's kingdom? The other one is self-centered. Hey, what do I have to do here to keep from getting singed in eternity? What happens if we buy into the self-centered model is we end up asking how much of this is allowable, how much whatever this thing is allowable, instead of how can I best carry Christ's love to a hurting world. If we ask the wrong questions, we'll get the wrong answers. Henry David Thoreau wrote a great many things that weren't quite right, but he did write one thing that was very accurate. He said, for every 1,000 people hacking at the leaves of evil, there is one person striking at the root. So you imagine a tree or a field of trees, and you have all these people trying to combat the trees, and they're hacking the leaves off, and the tree just grows new leaves. But he said, for every 1,000 of them, you have one person who's actually digging the tree out by the roots. When you dig the tree out by the roots, it's gone. So if we ask the wrong questions, we'll get the wrong answers. If we're trying to decide if we should do this thing or not, whatever the thing is, you fill in the blank, you've been there, you have a better idea about your life, and somebody will come along and say, well, I don't think you should be obsessing about this. I really don't think it's a salvation issue, and that's a wrong way of thinking. If the only reason we're here is to save our own, is the only reason we're here on earth to save our own souls from getting scorched in eternity? Or why are we here? We're here to do the work of Christ on earth. And what did Christ do? He healed the sick. He restored relationships with love. He forgave transgressors. He taught the truth. He pointed people to God, and he warned the erring. And which of those things do we not do on our own homes on a weekly basis? It's a child coming down in the middle of the night for Tylenol. It's the getting the two little boys to stop fighting. It's forgiving transgressors because they broke your great-grandmother's vase. It's the teaching the truth, the pointing them to God. It's warning the erring, hey, if you do that again, buddy, we're going to have a talk, and it's going to be more than that. We're here on earth to nurture and grow God's kingdom, and our home is a microcosm, a tiny bit of the whole that contains the elements of the whole. So if we can stop viewing Christianity as a way to save our souls, we need to stop viewing Christianity as a way to save our souls from the fire while still getting as much of the world as we can. Because that's like turning to Christ and saying, yep, I'll accept your mercy and grace that costs you more than the creation of the whole world. I'm not really all that interested in doing your work and promoting what matters to you. I'll just take enough of your grace here to keep me from frying, but I'm not really interested in your mission. Think about this. What would happen if you have a boy and a girl and they start dating, and the girl comes to her parents, imagine you're the parents, because a lot of you are, and she says, look, here's the deal. So I'm dating this boy, and he's pretty nice. I mean, he's as good as the next one. And I do want to get married because I don't want to, sorry, I dropped my notes. I don't want to end up at 50 years old and not be married. I really don't like that outcome. So I want to keep this boy, I think. The problem is he's kind of an interference in my life. I mean, so what we need to figure out here, what we need to figure out is, Mom, Dad, what do you think? Like, what do you think the minimum number of texts I should send him a day to kind of keep him on the line? Like, how often do you think I have to talk to this boy to keep him from dumping me? What would you do if you're the mom and dad? You'd say, okay, let's figure this thing out. I think about 3 texts a day. If you talk to him once a week, be sure to smile at him a couple times on your date weekends. Is that the way you would feel about it? Or would you say, hey, let us sit down. We need to talk about this thing. This doesn't sound good at all. Are you really sure this is what you want? Because you should really decide whether you're going to get in and get out on this relationship. No, I want to be in this relationship. I really want to be in this relationship. I mean, I don't like the outcomes of not being in this relationship. Look, I want to go to the beach with my friends this weekend. It's a date weekend. I've got to figure out, I mean, do you think if I'd send him some extra texts this weekend, make up for going with my friends? And the parents, if I was a parent, I'd be thinking, hey, there are red flags everywhere. This is not a good idea. When we relate to our families and our work of Christ in the world and our Christianity in that way, what we end up doing is constantly striving to find that line. How close can I get to get as much of the world as I can without crossing that red line where I get lost? And so you end up asking, like, how much business can I do? How much can I neglect my family without endangering their souls? Because business is less important than our children, so we definitely don't want to do anything that endangers our souls. So what is, like, how much business can I do before it endangers their children's souls? We ask questions like, how much wealth can I accumulate before I violate Christ's command not to lay up treasure on earth? I mean, really, how many bedtime stories do I really have to read to them to do my duty before I can go back to my smartphone? And how long do I have to sit here and nod politely at my child's chatter before I can go back to my Outlook inbox? How short do I have to cut my conversation with my sister in another state so I can get the children to bed on time? And what is the latest I can get home from work and still kind of have some time with my family? And honestly, ministry is not exempt from this. Even the question, what is the maximum amount of ministry trips I can take in a year before my wife starts to complain about overload? You see, it's the same paradigm of the girlfriend and the boyfriend, like, how many texts do I got to send? It's, what is the minimum I can do and still get the results I want while doing what I feel like it the rest of the time? It gets pretty practical. It's all centered around the core idea of what is the minimum that I must do to still get passable results. So what does it have to do with being there for our family? So we touched on it already. It gets pretty practical. It's the wrong question, the wrong context. Like, how much time can I spend staring at my smartphone? You can get apps, you can get, or whatever it is, for a lot of people carry smartphones, and you can find out what your daily screen time is. It's really high for most average people in the world. What is it, 6 or 7 hours a day or something completely ludicrous? That reminds me of another study. It was done in the California Bay Area, which is probably not strictly representative of our Anabaptist people. Nevertheless, I think it proves a point. And they put these body monitors on people, and they said, we want to see how much husband and wives talk in a day, or people in committed relationships. It is, after all, the California Bay Area. It may not be marriage, but how much time do people really spend communicating? Elmer and his wife, me and my wife, what are the numbers? And you know what the number they came up with? If I remember correctly, it was 5 minutes a day. It was like 5 minutes a day. And they said, and the researchers said, and the majority of that 5 minutes was transactional in basis. Are you going to pick the children up from school, or am I going to pick them up from school? That sort of question. Transactional conversations are obviously important, but they're not how relationships are built. And so now we have some idea of why relationships are breaking up all over the place is they're not real relationships. You can't have a relationship with somebody in 5 minutes a day. I mean, sure, you could have a relationship with your brother in church maybe on less time, and with the time you spend with them is quality time. You can't have a relationship with your wife and your family that way. It just doesn't work. The numbers aren't there. And I'm willing to guarantee that if they had pulled the smartphone records from them people, it would have been more than 5 minutes a day. So we have this huge gap between what they should be doing and what's actually happening. And so we end up asking questions like, how much technology can I allow into my life and my children's lives before it endangers their spiritual destiny? And they're all the wrong questions. They're all questions that source back to that same root hacking at the leaves of evil. The same girl that's asking, you know, does she have to send 3 texts a day? We're putting the priority on getting as much of the world, as much of the brokenness a lot of times of the world as we can into our lives and leaving out as much of our responsibility as we can. Like, it would make more sense if we should decide how much time our family actually needs from us and then just trim off everything else. That would be really hard to do in real life. But when we get to the end of the road and we're lying there on our deathbed, we're not going to look back and think, well, I did get, you know, an extra 20 minutes of scrolling through TikTok or YouTube videos by skipping that bedtime story. It's not going to happen. They're all ignorant questions because they're based on a self-centered carnal mindset. Other questions are harder, like how much ministry should we be involved in? How much involvement should I have that takes time from our family? And I don't have an answer to that question. Other people here know more about this. But I do have a little story my dad told me years ago. And he told me who it was. I don't remember. But there was 3 men with families that were involved in inner city mission. They were, I think, living maybe in the inner city, and they were trying to do mission. And finally the 3 men got together and they said, okay, and 2 of them said, here's the thing. They said, this is going to cost us our families, we think, if we keep this up. This is a bad environment, a lot of bad things going on. And one of them said, we all have about 12 children. So there's 3 men there, and they all had about roughly 12 children. And he said, that means that with the children and their wives and everything, he said, the 3 of us here are responsible for about 40 souls. And 2 of them said, the stakes are too high for us to risk our families on this venture. And so they said, we're pulling out. And the 3rd one said, nope, nope. This God has called me to this. This is my calling in life. This is what I need to be doing. And God's just going to fill in the gaps. I don't know what he said. I'm staying. He stayed. He lost his family. You can take out of that what you want. But I have a hard time seeing how that was God's will. The Bible says the wise foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Spiritual vision is being able to look forward not 3 years or 10 years, but being able to look 40 or 50 years into the future and say, this is the direction we need to be going. We might have to alter course a little bit, go around some trees and stumps to get there, but this is the direction we're going. And aggressively pursue that. We need to prioritize the love of God first at home. If it's not happening at home, probably external ministry is not a great place to be shedding the love of God if it's not happening at home. So how do we do that? Well, we can spend more time and less with our children and less screen time, less whatever it is, Outlook, inbox time, cell phone, whatever, work time. But just knowing we should do that is something most of us already know. So we had to hit that nail. To start out here, we had to make that point. But at the same time, in real life, it's kind of hard. Because life just, if the devil can't make you sin, he'll make you busy. It presses in around us and keeps taking chunks out of us. And so let's just get a little bit into some practical aspects of distraction avoidance. And this comes down to another core tenet of discipline, life discipline in general. Life discipline, essentially bringing your life into a code of conduct or into a structure that will get the results we want to get. The older I get, and I'm not nearly as old as some people, but the older I get, the more I see that there isn't multiple paths to the same truth. There isn't multiple ways to accomplish the same results. That in many cases, the ends pre-exist in the means. You have to use the right means to get the right ends because they pre-exist. They live nested inside the means. And so we have two mindsets here. We need to bring this thing under discipline. We need to bring our lives under discipline, whether it's a screen time, whether it's our work time, whether it's our ministry time, whatever it is. We need to prioritize our families, and we need to bring it under discipline. And there's two mindsets here. One is, I'm going to give it a good effort. I'm going to throw myself into it. I'm going to give it a good effort. That sounds good. Nobody's going to be able to fault me for not trying. The other mindset is, I'll do whatever it takes. It's a very different mindset. One of them is based on I'm going to put in enough. I'm going to put in enough so that people looking on and even myself and everybody's going to say, yeah, he really tried. And the other one says, this isn't about trying, folks. This is about results. So if we die in the process, well, then you can be dead. That's fine. But the results have to be there. And our martyred forefathers, that was their take on life. They said, dying is acceptable. Failing is not, so kill me. We have to get to that. Once again, it actually returns kind of back to that core principle we talked about earlier, except now it's being rephrased a little bit. I'll give it a good effort versus I'll do whatever it takes. Here's a truth that I didn't get until more recently in life, and it's sort of been... It's been a big deal to me. She pulled it out of the book Atomic Habits by James Clear. And he's not a Christian, but it's just a book on life change. And the reality is we're all humans, so life change principles are true whether you're a Christian or not. If you're going to change some element of your life, a lot of the same things apply. We have the Spirit of God, so we should be making better decisions. But the work that goes into it is still going to be relevant whether you're a Christian or not. If you want to make significant life change, you're going to have to do whatever it takes. And he said the most disciplined people are not people who necessarily have more willpower than other people, than undisciplined people. Think about that. I've always thought, oh, those people that they have their life in track and everything's running on schedule, or they prioritize the right thing, even if it's not running on schedule, they prioritize the right things, because sometimes schedules need to be pushed onto a back burner in order to prioritize the right thing. And I look at that and I say, wow, they must really have a lot of something I don't have. And James Clear is saying, no, they don't. He's saying they don't have so much more willpower than anybody else. But what they do have that undisciplined people don't have is they have much, much better structures, much better life structures. They're not relying on willpower to get things done. Because willpower will come and it'll go. It's a limited commodity. It fades out on us. But if you have a structure you've built around yourself, that tends to just be there day in and day out. And it takes a lot less effort to keep repairing your structure than it does to keep trying to pull yourself up by your bootstraps through willpower. That's a life principle. Relying on willpower to change entrenched human behavior is a fool's path. Doesn't work. Okay? Not permanently, sure. You can do it for a day or two or maybe a month. But willpower is limited. That's one of the more interesting things that has come out of behavioral science. Is willpower is limited. And they've done studies on people where they pushed them in a situation which required more willpower and then put them in another situation and put other people in a lower stress situation and then pushed them into the same situation. The people who were already in a situation that required using willpower did worse at the next thing because they'd already used up some of their day's supply. And we kind of seem to think that we're exempt from that because we're Christians and we have the Spirit of God and we can just not structure anything, and the Spirit of God is just going to somehow give us all this willpower to get through life. It doesn't work that way. If you found it that way, great. Maybe you should come talk to me afterwards. I haven't found it that way. The rules of being a human apply. It's like a bank account. It refills day by day, but it's never going to be enough to run your life that way. So we have to ration out situations that require willpower. It should be obvious. It should be an obvious truth, but willpower takes effort. And anything that takes effort cannot be unlimited. It can't be. Whether you're picking up marbles or whether you're keeping from eating that donut, eventually if you keep doing something long enough, you're going to get tired. And then you're going to be, and eventually you're going to not be able to do it anymore, even if it's something relatively simple. I used to be into distance running a little bit, not terribly serious, but sometimes I'd knock off 5 and sometimes maybe as much as 6 miles on a night. And I had this theory about life that you can always take one more step. I mean, it's just one more step. You can always take one more step. You know what? It's not true. And I hit a point in my life, and it wasn't in distant running, but I hit a point in my life where your body just says, all right, that's it, you're done. Then what? That can happen. And so it's not smart to rely on an idea that says you can always take one more step. I'm just going to use willpower, and I'm just going to keep going. Because eventually your mind or your body can just say, oh, actually, nope, I'm pulling the plug on this. The breakers flip, the lights are going out. This is stopping right here. Survival mode kicks in. You can incrementally increase your willpower, just like you can incrementally increase your running speed. If I kept running day after day, I would eventually get a little faster than I am. But even the best runner in the world is slow compared to a cheetah. And who is the fastest runner in the world? Just trivia. Usain Bolt, and he's been laser measured at just under 28 miles an hour, which is really scorching. A cheetah can hit 70 miles an hour by something like the third bounce. 70 miles an hour is pretty fast. So even if you're insane Usain Bolt, the cheetah's going to get you. But humans in airliners, they're a bit faster. That's more like 600 miles an hour. And even a cheetah can only sustain 70 miles an hour for a few seconds. Whereas humans in cars, we drive here at 70 miles an hour for 5 hours. So if we're trying to bring our life into control, we talked about priorities. Now we're talking about following the priorities. If we're going to bring our lives under control, we're going to have to stop trying to run faster. And we're going to have to get ourselves an airliner or a car. No matter how fast you think you are, Usain Bolt is faster. No matter how fast Usain Bolt is, the cheetah will get him every time in the first 100 meters. You can't beat a rigged system by trying harder. In technology, for instance, if you're going to stop doom scrolling on a site that has maybe had indirectly or direct 1,000 elite programmers has worked on this site, and they've maybe brought in behavioral scientists to fortify their position, and brought in psychologists to fortify their position, and like Google's homepage, they tried, 40 different colors, tiny tweaks of blue, the blue header bar, just to find out which one. So they're trying all these things. They have the data, and they have an unlimited amount of, huge amounts of bandwidth, and the brightest minds in the world trying to overcome your tendency to say, I really need to stop doing this and go do the laundry. You've already lost. The brightest minds in the world are teaming up against you. It's the equivalent of being a super overweight man running across the savannah. The cheetah doesn't even have to break a sweat. Willpower without behavioral modification does not work. Willpower is still necessary, of course. Well, why is willpower necessary? We're going to build great structures. We're going to structure everything, and there's not going to be any willpower needed. Well, for one thing, life doesn't work that way. I don't care how good you are at structuring things. You're going to run into situations that are out of the ordinary. And if you are so good at structuring things, you don't run into situations that are out of the ordinary. You're probably driving your structures over all sorts of other people's lives. And so we're going to need willpower. We're going to need willpower because life demands it of us. I like to think of an analogy like this. So when they build a high-rise concrete building, they can put all these forms and structures in place around where they're going to pour the concrete, and they can pour a floor or two. I don't know what the actual number is, but they can pour a limited number of floors high. And then they have to stop. Because that concrete, yeah, sure, it's set up overnight, and it looks great, but it's still green. And it's not nearly as strong as it should be. And they might can even pull a lot of the the forms and supporting material off of that structure, and it'll stand there, and it looks great, and it'll stand there for 100 years if you leave it that way. But you have to let it cure to where it's truly up to strength. And then you can take your forms and you can move them up to the next level, and you can pour a couple more floors on top of that first floor. After it sets up, you can pop the forms off and let it cure. You can keep going up and up and up and up. There's that building in the Middle East that's way over 1,000. What is it? 1,000 foot tall. I don't even remember how tall it is. But it's way up there. And you can go way up into the sky if you follow that method. But here's what happens if you don't follow the method. I'm not a concrete person. This is the way I understand it. She can correct me if I'm wrong. But if you just keep pouring floors on top of floors, those bottom floors are not set up yet. They're green. What's going to happen is sooner or later, one of those supporting structures, the floors, is going to buckle. It's going to collapse. And when it happens, it's going to drop that whole structure onto the floor below it. Boom, a big pancake implosion, and that's going to buckle the floor under that, and it's going to go pop, 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 right down, and the whole building's going to collapse into just a huge pile of broken concrete and rebar. That's the way it is too often in our life. We look at our lives, and we're like, okay, some stuff's got to change here. You're looking at your wife and saying, yeah, we got to do something different. This isn't working. We're going to have to get some structure here, and we're going to change a whole bunch of things. We're going to fix this, we're going to fix it right. It's like building that building. Like trying to put up 30 floors in green concrete. You can't do it. You have to start. It's not the way humans are wired. You have to start somewhere and lay a baseline down, put down a foundation and says this will happen every day or every day that falls within this set of perimeters. And you're going to have to put it there and let it cure. It may take you 3 months. It may take you 6 months. It may take you a year, 18 months. You have to put something in place and let it cure. Let it be the foundation. Let it be the first couple of floors. Then you can build a couple of floors on top of it. You can't organize your life all at once. You can't look at your life and say, okay, this isn't working. We're going to just fix it all. You just have to start somewhere. And like pouring green concrete, you can do something today, but you can't do it all today. And just like, and too often in my life, I think I've been trying to be that person that's saying, let's just build the whole building all at once. Let's not mess around with this curing business. Let's just going to build the whole structure all at once. And what happens is it looks great. It goes up quick. Wow, we're making changes. This is working, folks. And then it all comes down a lot faster. But once we find that, okay, here's my priority, we're not going to put the minimum in. We're going to do whatever it takes. Okay, now we're going to build something. Go slow. Put down something, make it permanent, go slow. So attempting behavioral change in the face of something addictive, like addictive technology, by trying harder is ignorant. It's foolishness. You'll lose. So specifically looking at technology here, there's things we can do. And it's a lot better to make one, it's much easier actually, to make a rational decision one time than to try to keep making a rational decision every time we're in a situation. This is why I premised it by saying you have to go back to saying, I don't care if it's an honest effort or not, I only want something that works. Because some of the things you may have to resort to if you're into an addiction or even just a distraction, you're holding on to that brand flake. You're holding on to that brand flake and you can't figure out how to let it go because by now your hands have basically grown into the thing. You have to do whatever it takes. And I've seen people mock this idea. But we're not concerned about whether it looks rational or not. We're only concerned if it works. Okay? There's things you can do on electronic devices. For example, I use a program called Cold Turkey Blocker. They also have another program, Micromanager. And it allows you to... So at CAM, I work behind an internet filter, and that's wonderful. But it doesn't matter if your filter is working and doing its job. You can still waste time online. Well, I got to look this up. It's a legitimate need. I need to go and go down that rabbit hole. And so I've already used something called Cold Turkey Blocker, which allows you to set up your own filter inside of it and say, I'm going to allow these websites all the time. and I'm going to block out everything else from this period of the morning to this period of the morning. If I need, here's a site I need to go on to because I need to access CAM Foundation's website, but it's not going to draw me down a rabbit hole. So you put in these parameters and you say, and you lock it down, and you can, there's a variety of ways to do it. You can do it by password, you can give your wife the password, the way I prefer using it is just random character. You can put in up to, I think, 999 random characters. So if you say, hey, I've got to unblock this site, you can unblock it. It'll take you 20 minutes of super intense concentration to get through all those random characters, but you can do it. If something like this would help you in your home, then this is what you should be doing. And it's easy to laugh and say, I'll just use more self-discipline. I don't need to do anything ridiculous like it. We already talked about that. Self-discipline, not self-discipline, effort doesn't work. You do what it takes. Micromanager is another program I use that allows you to lock your computer down to just these few apps. Like I could make Outlook and Microsoft Word allowable and nothing else works. And I can set it for an hour. And I can sit down and I can say, all right, we're going to write for an hour. And I'm going to have my email there in case I need it, but I'm going to write for an hour. Maybe you need to lock your email out. Okay, so that works at work, but it's the same principle at home. If something is biting chunks out of us and we keep falling and falling and falling in the same area, find a way to fix it. And if it seems ludicrous to you, do it without it, but you're going to probably struggle. It's a lot better to just say, hey, what's it going to take? And then do that thing. You can set your computer to where it will shut down, like black screen, from 5 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning. And that seems crazy. Oh, we're humans. We're rational human beings. We don't have to do any of that nonsense. And then we find ourselves there at 6 o'clock at night still working. We do what it takes. There's also things in the non-digital world called commitment devices. This really gets into the bizarre. But they work, and they've been proven to work. And that is, you sit down with somebody who matters to you, and you say, all right, Elmer, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make sure that I am home at 5:30 every night. And if I don't, we're going to work out a set of consequences. And I'm going to either have to, if I break my own rule, I'm going to either have to pay up whatever the consequences are, or I'm going to have to lie to Elmer. Those aren't good options. So we do it. And that really seems strange to people. We say, humans should not have to act that way. Actually, humans do act that way all the time. And the reason that people make New Year's resolutions, they're going to lose weight this year, and at the end of the year, they're just as heavy as they were at the beginning of the year, is because they tried it on willpower. And there are a lot of other factors that actually play into that one. But whatever we're trying to accomplish, we can either take the attitude that we're going to try our best, or we can take the attitude as we're going to be ludicrous. We're going to be ridiculous if we have to, but we're going to win. We are going to win this one. It's more of a special forces approach to warfare. It's saying, oh, we don't care what it costs, and we don't care what we have to use to do it, but we are going to take this bridge. So you can set reminders on your phone to call your wife 3 times a day, whatever it is, if that's what your relationship needs. Structure it, and you'll have a pretty good chance of pulling it off. I want to talk just a little bit now about habits and tradition. Habits, good habits, good structure as tradition. One of the things we've done at our house sometimes is we use a supper tradition like lighting a candle. So it works like this. At supper time, everybody's sitting around the table being noisy and typically acting like little Dursteins. And okay, it's time for supper to start. It's supper time. You get out a box of matches and I have this beeswax candle in a holder in the middle of the table. Whose turn is it tonight? It's Cam's turn tonight, okay? Give Cam the box of matches. This can get interesting. And he lights, they might have to strike for a while, and they might burn their fingers, and they might drop it on the tablecloth and burn the tablecloth. So you shouldn't have a lace tablecloth, right? And they get the candle lighted. That person gets to pick what we pray for prayer. Like, are we going to sing a prayer song, whatever we are? After prayer, that person gets to talk first. And they can talk about whatever they want to. They can usually talk about their day. That's what they're encouraged to talk about. And so what happens in reality is they're describing their version of the day, and somebody else is over there. It's like, no, it didn't happen like that. That's fine. You'll get your turn to talk later. go around the table and everybody tell them about their day. It's a way to structure communication in the home. Everybody says, this is what happened in my day. Well, it didn't happen exactly like that. When he was telling it, hey, we got both sides of the story. Wonderful. At least it wasn't just a jumble of everybody yelling at the same time. Habits is traditions. Habits, structure is games. Here's one the children like. We don't do near often enough. We need to do more of it. It's called rolling the orange. Somebody will grab an orange, and they sit there, and they look across the table, and they can pick. This is after supper now. The dishes are put away. And they can roll the orange to anybody on the table they want to, and they can ask them anything they want. And you're supposed to answer. Oh, they like doing it. Roll them the orange. Okay, so what is your... I think it'll get a lot more interesting when we get into our teen years. But anyway, that's... They can ask them anything they want. And, well, then they've got the orange. So now when they're done answering, however they figured out how to do that, they can pick the next person and they can roll the orange to them until everybody has been used up. You're structuring communication to make sure that it happens and turning it into a game. What about work? Let's talk about work. One thing, like I talked about, you can set up a program. Cold Turkey isn't the only one. There's other ones that work as well. You can set your work computer to shut down at a certain time of the day. It's black screen you. If you're having trouble getting home at night, that might be what you need to do. Well, say, what if I'm having trouble getting home for other reasons, or maybe I don't work at a computer? You're going to have to figure this one out for yourself. One thing I've found to be helpful is if you can do ride sharing. And what that means is, unless you're going to be really hard to live with, you're going to be at that person's place and pick them up at the right time in the morning. And you can even turn that into a game. I'm going to try to be there. I'm supposed to be there a quarter after, but I'm going to try to be there, you know, 1 minute early, see how long I can do that. But that gets you to work at a certain time. But then at the end of the day, that person comes walking down the hall and it's time to go. And you're either going to make them sit out in the car and wait for you for 15 minutes, or you're going to wrap your stuff up and you're going to go home. It's a way of structuring our life to get the results we want. And once again, that's how we do it. We structure it. Of course, we already talked about technology using Cold Turkey. You can also do things like if you tend to surf the web too late at night. One highly intelligent person from, I think it was from that book, Atomic Habits, they set their router on a timer. You know, there's click timers you can get at Lowe's, and they hook that to their router connection. And so at whatever, 8 o'clock at night, the router goes down. That's it. Oh, you could go turn the wheel and reset it, I suppose, but it gives you just that nudge you need to actually start getting ready for bed. Another thing James Clear talked about, he said he sets his social media accounts, which I don't have any social media accounts, but he said he has a secretary that goes in every Monday morning and changes all his social media passwords. He don't know what they are. And he said all week there's no social media. He said Friday night before she goes home, I guess, she sends him an email, here's your social media passwords. He said he can get on Facebook or whatever all weekend long, Monday morning, everything's gone down again. And you get things done. But we're not prioritizing for work here. We're prioritizing for family. But the rules still apply. With wealth, not something I have a lot of experience with, but you can put yourself on a salary and you can give everything else away above that. Some people do reverse tithing where they give 90% and they keep 10%. That's switching from the mentality of how big, you can switch to the mentality of how big is the need instead of how much do I need to give. What about ministry? Well, it's not our ministry, honestly. We're involved in ministry. It's not ours. It's God's ministry. And we shouldn't be in it alone. We probably need pre-arranged travel caps and nights away from home. Just decide ahead of time we're not spending more than X amount of nights on the road, and that's it. And make ourselves accountable to a board if we need to. The fact is, the needs out there are bigger than you are, period, full stop. You will not be able to meet them all. So if the family is a primary responsibility, you have to remember that they are your primary responsibilities, and you have to aggressively schedule for that. And that means you are not going to be able to meet the needs, but you know what? You weren't going to be able to meet those needs, all those needs anyway. And we don't want to end up like that man who stayed in town because he felt like he had a call from God and lost his whole family because he wasn't willing to prioritize. That's all I have. Thank you for listening this weekend and for everything you've done. I'll turn it back over to Elmer.